Hello everyone and welcome to this episode of DAC Beechcroft's NHS Estates podcast. My name is Casina Omacobia and I am an associate in the real estate team specialising in health. I'm your host and today we will be talking about NHS property acquisitions and routes to occupation of property. Not just some of the legal nuts and bolts, but the practical realities too. I'm joined by my colleague Dean Parrott, a legal director in our real estate team who advises across the NHS and wider public sector.
Hi Casina, thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you today to discuss this topic. Property acquisitions in the NHS can sometimes be challenging and there's a lot to get right from day one.
Absolutely. Over the next 15 to 20 minutes or so, we'll briefly cover acquisition routes, due diligence, strategy and governance, commercial terms, execution and post-completion. We'll also touch on CDEL principles and principles from the NHS Estate Code, where relevant to acquisitions. The NHS Estate Code is the guidance that underpins good estate management across the NHS.
Quick one, Casina. I'm often asked by clients, is the NHS Estate Code actually binding on NHS trusts and NHS foundation trusts?
Generally, no. Not in the it's law sense anyway. Estate Code is guidance and best practice standards, so it doesn't automatically have the force of legislation.
So are you saying trusts can just ignore it?
No, definitely not. They can depart from it, but that doesn't mean they should.
I agree with you on that, Casina. Interestingly, I have seen estate code become effectively binding in a few ways. For example, if a property contract references it, or if NHS England ties approvals, funding or business case sign-off to certain aspects of it. Importantly, many NHS bodies bake compliance with estate code into their own internal governance, policies and procedures, and that is always worth checking at the outset of a transaction.
Great. Thanks, Dean. Let's start with the why. Dean, why does an NHS body decide to acquire property?
Generally, because property is a tool for delivering essential healthcare services. If you're trying to expand capacity, move care closer to communities, or redesign pathways, say you need more diagnostics, more outpatient activity, more community health provision, you often need the right space in the right location. Let's not forget also that space will be needed for non-clinical staff to work and support their clinical colleagues.
So it's not property for property's sake?
Exactly. Typical drivers are improving access for patients, consolidating multiple smaller sites into one hub, replacing poor quality or inefficient buildings, or co-locating with partners like local authorities, social care or the voluntary sector to make integrated care work.
And I guess there's a cost and control angle too.
Absolutely, Casina. Sometimes the business case is about long-term cost control and flexibility. Whether you want the certainty of owning the asset or the agility of leasing or something in between. That's where the method of acquisition of the property really matters.
And that's where the NHS Estate Code comes in. It emphasises strategic planning, governance, option appraisal and whole life value, not just the cheapest upfront price. It aligns with managing public money and the Treasury Green Book approach to business cases.
Exactly. Before NHS property managers talk to vendors or landlords, they'll be thinking, does this option advance clinical outcomes? Is it affordable throughout its life? And does it represent value for money? Estate Code encourages transparent decision-making, proportionate assurance, and using independent valuation to support transactions.
So presumably the property team will also be having early conversations with their finance colleagues?
Absolutely. And we see this all the time. Because even if the acquisition is clinically perfect, if it blows the trust CDEL allocation, it either won't get signed or it gets delayed while the team find a financially compliant route through.
So what does CDEL discipline look like at a deal level?
We are veering into finance and accounting aspects here, Casina. But the trust will run the numbers early, asking questions like, what's the capital impact? When does it hit? And are they within delegated limits or heading for a higher approval? That's why estates and finance teams work closely together to ensure compliance.
So tell me, what happens if the preferred acquisition can't proceed?
There could be a number of options, including deciding that the acquisition can't proceed at all. We have also worked with various clients to think of all sorts of redesigns of a transaction to achieve the same service and clinical outcome within the CDEL envelope. For example, you could phase the project, so spend lands across different financial years. You can look to adjust the scope of an acquisition so you're not buying too much too soon. or switching structure entirely, like considering developer delivery with staged payments, or partner arrangements where the NHS Trust isn't the tenant of the lease, but the lease might then include complicated and varied step-in provisions to enable the Trust to step in and provide the service if it needs to. Or the Trust enters into an occupational lease which might have less CDEL impact and may contain options to renew or require the reversion. It would be important to ensure that the acquisition genuinely fits the clinical model and the accounting profile.
Thanks, Dean. So let's talk routes to occupation. What are the typical models that an NHS body might use to occupy property?
In my simple mind, Cassina, I think of it as a spectrum, from we own and control it at one end to we just need a room on Tuesdays at the other. And the route that's chosen depends on how long you need it, how much control you need, and how much risk you can carry.
Okay, so start on the own and control end, please.
Well, that's freehold ownership. A trust buys the entire site and occupies as owner. It gives maximum control, redevelopment potential, long-term service planning, perhaps fewer constraints, but it's capital heavy and you inherit all the life cycle responsibilities like maintenance, compliance, and the cost of making the property fit for clinical use.
So the next step down, you don't own it, but the acquisition means you have medium or long-term certainty.
Yes, that's generally leasehold occupation, which might even be a long lease. You get a certain level of control for a defined term, sometimes with repair and service charge obligations, and you can usually fit out properly. It's common for community services, like clinics, admin hubs, anywhere you need stability, but you're not buying the freehold. Think 5, 10, 15 years, with the length of term often dictated by initial capital expenditure. For example, the higher the cost of the fit-out or specialist medical equipment might require a longer lease term to satisfy the business case. The lease will likely also have a market rent, probably with rent reviews, which might be open market reviews or index linked, perhaps with a collar and a cap. Generally, NHS bodies will want flexibility in their leases, perhaps with break options, because flexibility in this ever-changing health landscape can be just as valuable as certainty.
And what about short-term or flexible space, which we saw a lot during the pandemic back in 2020, for things like vaccine hubs?
Then you're often into licences to occupy. A licence is permission to use space without granting a lease. Useful for, as you say, Cassina, pop-up clinics, vaccination centres, pilots, or decant space during refurbishments. The upside is speed and flexibility. The downside is less protection. You may have fewer rights and you can be required to leave on short notice depending on the terms.
And sometimes you see managed space arrangements.
Yes, although less popular in the health space, serviced offices, managed clinical space and sessional rooms. Here, quite often, you're paying for a package, space plus services, rather than taking on a full repairing lease. Operationally, it can be brilliant. You can start delivering care quickly, but you still need to check basics like data security, patient confidentiality, accessibility, infection control standards, and who is responsible for alterations and compliance.
And what about acquiring or occupying property that's already in the wider NHS family?
Yes, that's really common and is generally encouraged. You might occupy via arrangements with NHS Property Services or Community Health Partnerships, or through inter-NHS agreements, sometimes documented as leases, sometimes as licences, and sometimes via occupier agreements or MOTOs. It can sometimes feel internal, but it still needs to be properly documented. Who maintains? Who pays? What happens if the services change? And who holds the keys? Literally and legally.
And sometimes the route to acquisition or occupation starts before the building exists.
Absolutely, that's right. That's where you see agreements for lease, development agreements or pre-let arrangements. The NHS Trust commits to take a lease or buy the property once the developer delivers the building to specification. It's a route that can unlock new space, but it needs tight drafting. What happens if practical completion is late or the specification doesn't meet clinical needs? We are also seeing more turnkey arrangements where the NHS takes a fully fitted out space in return perhaps for a higher rent or a capital contribution. With these types of transactions, you need to be mindful of the procurement rules. It's beyond the scope of this podcast, but where a public body is having something built or constructed for it, we always need to be mindful of and look out for procurement traps and ensure the correct advice is sought at the right time.
That's great. Thanks, Dean.
Cassina, I know our colleagues Lisa and Victoria have touched on this in a previous DACB NHS Estates podcast, which is definitely worth a listen, but can you remind us of the value of heads of terms in respect of an acquisition?
Certainly. Heads of terms are the deal sketch. They are usually non-binding and subject to contract, but they lock down the commercial points so lawyers, estates colleagues and finance colleagues aren't guessing, and they're a great discipline check before you spend time and fees.
So what would you suggest they must contain?
So start with the basics, like parties to the transaction, are consents needed, and if so, from whom? A clear property description, what's included, the transaction type, freehold purchase, long lease, rack rent lease, license, and the price or rent. Then key dates, target exchange and completion, any exclusivity period, and what due diligence is needed. Title, searches, surveys, asbestos, utilities. Also, I would suggest to spell out conditions such as board CDL approval, planning, vacant possession, or what leases stay in place. And in addition, VAT position, deposit, apportionment, who pays costs, and confidentiality. If it's a lease, include the lease term, break rights, rent reviews, and mechanics for the review, repairing, FRI, service charge, alterations, and whether or not it is to be contracted out of the 1954 Act.
Thanks, Cassina. You mentioned due diligence, so let's move on to talking about that. Once a site has been found that could work for the services, and before anything is signed, what does due diligence actually mean in property acquisition terms?
It's basically two work streams running in parallel. Legal due diligence, which us lawyers would undertake. Can the NHS Trust own or occupy the property safely? And are there any legal traps? And then there is a technical due diligence, which the Trust or its advisors would undertake, and we might support or feed into that. Is the building and the land physically fit for what the NHS Trust needs? And what will it cost to make it compliant?
Thanks, Cassina. Let's start with the legal. What are you looking at first?
Firstly, title. If it's registered land, I'd be reviewing the land registry title and title plan. Who owns the property, what class of title it is, and what's on the title by way of charges, restrictions, easements, covenants, and the oddities like mines and minerals or airspace exclusions. I would be considering the impact of all of this in light of the method of acquisition and the proposed use of the property.
Okay, great. What's the difference between those things?
So firstly, rights and easements. Like rights of way, rights to run services, rights to park, either benefiting the property or burdening it. Secondly, covenants. Promises in old deeds like no clinical use or no building above one storey or only as a private dwelling, that sort of thing. Thirdly, restrictions. Land registry stop signs. You can't register your purchase unless some condition is met, like a certificate or a deed of covenant. And then charges, mortgages or legal charges. You need them discharged on completion.
And what about boundaries?
Absolutely. Title plans are general boundaries. So if the layout is tight when taking into account things like car parks, access roads, ambulance bays, plant compounds, drop-off areas, etc., you often need a measured survey, and you might check whether the fence is where the plan suggests.
Okay, great. So title is the paper ownership side. What's next?
So up next would be planning. You check the lawful planning use, the site's planning history, and whether there are conditions that would trip you up, like limits on hours, deliveries, parking numbers, or requirements for travel plans.
And Cassina, in your view, what are the big ticket planning risks?
So just a few classics that we might come across include the use you propose to put the property to isn't lawful without planning permission, or there are planning conditions you can't comply with, so an application to vary or remove those conditions might be necessary. This can often arise in respect of opening hours. Then there are Section 106 obligations, like ongoing contributions or restrictions, or community infrastructure levy issues, or the building is listed or in a conservation area, or there's no obvious lawful access from the public highway.
And what about highways? Why is that important?
What you want to know is whether the property directly adjoins a highway maintained at public expense, and to check that is the access point. If not, how is access to the property gained? If it's private access, who maintains it? And what are your rights to use it? That then feeds into cost and operational reliability. Imagine arguing about potholes over an access road when you're trying to run a clinic.
Thanks, Casina. Yes, I can see that as a bit of an operational nightmare. Turning to searches, I am sometimes asked why these are necessary and what is actually needed. What searches would you usually undertake? What do you consider to be the shopping list?
So, typically, I'd start with a local authority search, which reveals planning permissions, enforcement notices, adoption of roads, compulsory purchase proposals, tree preservation orders, and the like. I'd then commission a drainage and water search. That will tell us if the property is connected to mains water, where are the sewers, can you build over them? And then an environmental search, which will inform potential contamination risk, landfill, ground stability, flood indicators. And then depending on location, coal mining or other mining searches, HS2, Crossrail, safeguarding, utility searches, and sometimes commons village green checks if it's rural.
And what about inquiries?
Yes, so alongside searches, you ask inquiries of the seller or landlord. For commercial property, that's often a standard set of inquiries. For example, CPSEs, which reveal things such as what disputes are there, what notices have been sent or received, what work have been done, what asbestos information exists, what EPC information is available, what service contracts are in place, and so on.
Great, thanks, Casina. That's legal. What about technical due diligence? What does that cover?
So it's generally broad, but the core is building survey, which will look at the condition of the property. Big ticket items will likely include the roof, the structure, any damp, and the state of the condition of the facade. M&E survey, electrical capacity, backup power, heating, ventilation, and air cooling, medical gases and oxygen, if relevant, plant condition and life cycle costs. Also, asbestos surveys, especially in older estates, and what management plan exists. And then we'd look at fire safety, compartmentation, alarms, means of escape, cladding questions where relevant, and then utilities capacity. Can the building cope with the proposed healthcare service load? Scanners, refrigeration, ventilation, oxygen, those kind of things. And then access and layout, DDA accessibility, ambulance and patient drop-off, patient flows, parking, servicing, security, gas or oxygen storage, quench pipes for MRIs. And then environmental, looking at things like contamination, flooding and invasive species.
And what about energy performance?
Yes, but briefly, as energy performance is a whole different podcast, which our colleagues Maddie and Terry dealt with recently. EPC and MEES risk, even if you're not a property lawyer, you need to know if the building is going to require expensive upgrades to be lettable or workable.
And how does due diligence vary by the type of acquisition?
Think of it like this. The more control you're buying, the more risk you inherit, and the deeper you ought to dig. So, with a freehold acquisition, you're taking the whole asset and its history. So, diligence is widest. So, title, everything, covenants, rights, boundary risk, mines, minerals, looking for ransom strips, restrictions and charges. And then planning, lawful use and any development potential or constraints. Searches, a full suite, because you can't hand the property back if you discover something after you've bought it. Technical, you're effectively on the hook for the whole life cycle, so surveys and cost forecasting really matter.
So with a freehold purchase, you're buying the problems and associated liability, as well as the building itself.
Exactly. Similarly, with a lease, you still do a lot, but you're also interrogating the lease terms, such as, what's the demise? what exactly are you occupying or have the right to occupy? We're looking at repairing obligations. Are you taking a full repairing lease? And what does that mean, given the building condition? Then there's service charge. What's recoverable? Are there any caps? And are there major works planned? Alterations. Can you fit out for clinical use? Plant on roof? Signage, data, cabling. We also look at alienation. Can you assign or underlet if you change service models? And break clauses, are they real or booby-trapped with conditions?
And presumably you also check the landlord's title?
Yes, enough to be comfortable the landlord can grant the lease and that the rights granted in the lease work, plus a check over any superior leases. You don't want a head lease expiring before the underlease term ends, as that could create all sorts of complications. And you want to ensure any head lease does not contain a break right before its underlease ends, as that could be fatal for the survival of the underlease and make any fit outs, costs or upfront expenditure wasted. However, a license is a lighter touch in terms of due diligence. The focus shifts. You're not getting a property interest in the same way, so you prioritise operational risks such as access, hours, exclusivity, security and shared areas. You want crystal clear termination rights, such as notice periods and what happens to the equipment and fit out. You can still check health and safety, fire safety and insurances, because you can't run services in an unsafe space just because it's a licence.
Thanks, Cassina. So in your view, what's the takeaway?
So due diligence isn't a tick box exercise. It's the moment you prove, can you legally occupy the property? Can you physically operate in it? And do the documents match the reality on the ground? Freehold acquisitions generally require the deepest and broadest due diligence. Leases add a major layer of terms risk. Licenses are faster, but you lean heavily into practical and operational protections. Governance is also essential. Dean, in your view, what does good governance look like in practice?
I suggest the starting point is clarity on authorities, like who can approve what, which thresholds, and what evidence is required. Board oversight is vital for material transactions. Estate code highlights the need for proportionate assurance, independent valuation, and transparent documentation supporting decisions.
Yeah, that's right. Many transactions will need a compliant business case. Depending on the size and risk, there may be external approval requirements as well as internal ones. The key is to plan the approval pathway early, so the acquisition timetable is realistic.
Yes, that's right. There should also be alignment with managing public money principles, regularity, proprietary, and value for money. Conflicts must be declared and managed, and the audit trail must show why the chosen option is best overall, not just the cheapest. Where partnerships involve local authorities or private providers, we should also be mindful of and consider subsidy control, procurement interface, and public law duties.
So let's translate diligence into deal terms. What would you suggest a client pushes for if the due diligence reveals holes or gaps?
That's interesting, Cassina. For a freehold acquisition, I would be discussing with clients a potential price adjustment for defects or missing consents, with retention or escrow where completion is time critical. I would also be looking for conditions precedent for any planning or change of use risks. Clear responsibility for remedial works with warranties and step-in where third parties are involved. And for leasehold deals, perhaps service charge caps where possible, clear landlord repair standards, and practical rights to alter and install clinical equipment. Rent reviews should align with budget certainty, perhaps index linked with collars and caps, which can be better than open market reviews for predictability. We also care about disruption provisions, particularly in leases, like notice periods for landlords' works, quiet enjoyment protections, and compensation if services fail. Break rights that are exercisable on realistic conditions aligned with clinical commissioning cycles. Assignment and underletting flexibilities to support service transformation might also be critical.
Thanks, Dean. So we all know that for property transactions, timetables can slip. What helps you keep momentum without compromising assurance?
For my transactions, which are perhaps time critical, I would usually suggest a single shared plan covering due diligence, approvals and third party dependencies. weekly check-ins with a concise red, amber, green status. If the vendor is running a tight long stop, we need to negotiate realistic milestones and look to extend them if needed.
Yes, and on documents, I would suggest to keep it clean. Agree heads of terms and ensure they are aligned to the business case. Then the contract, whether it's a transfer, agreement for lease or development agreement, ensure they follow those principles. Use collateral warranties from designers and contractors where the NHS will rely on their work. Confirm PI levels, step-in rights and latent defect coverage.
And after completion, we will deal with stamp duty formalities. We will register the title to the lease or the transfer at the land registry and deal with any land registry requisitions. For clinical operations, clients will need to coordinate any Care Quality Commission location updates or procure registrations. They might also need to test emergency procedures and complete final safety sign-offs before opening.
Thanks, Dean. So, any final quick tips?
For me, I would suggest start with strategy and options, stress test operational fit, and be honest about lifecycle cost, and build governance into your plan.
And finally, from me, we must get the basics right. Title, planning, surveys, consents, and permissions, and let the business case drive the deal, not the other way round.
Thanks, Cassina, that's great. We've come to the end of our podcast on NHS property acquisitions. And I definitely think you and I should do another of these soon, focusing on leasehold acquisitions by NHS bodies.
Yes, Dean, that would be great. Thanks, everyone, for listening.